too many entrepreneurs get started, and because they're afraid of, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Should I spend the money? I don't want to hire somebody because I'm afraid they won't justify their cost. I'm afraid, even if I have employees, to turn over critical tasks because I can naturally do them better and faster, so I might as well do them. And I'm afraid if I let somebody else do it, they won't do it as good. I'm afraid I might lose a customer. I'm afraid that, and it's that fear that keeps people from saying, okay, I really need to scale this company. So if I'm going to do that, I can't be doing the dishes. I can't be washing the floors. I can't be cleaning up after everybody. I can't be cleaning out the refrigerator. I can't do those things. I can't do the administrative tasks. I can't do the sales and marketing. I can't do the it's that fear that somebody else won't do it as well as you that keeps you from scaling.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Welcome to this edition of the John Papaloni Show. Today we have Brian Will. Brian, welcome to the show.
John, thanks for having me. It's going to be a good show. I'm excited.
Absolute pleasure. It's a delight. Let's start off the podcast with a description of who you are, what you do, and how you got there.
Oh, gosh, that's like a 10-minute conversation. Let me see if I can squeeze it into 30 seconds. serial entrepreneur, 35 years, multiple industries, started in landscaping, went to insurance, went into the internet world, back to insurance, went into restaurants, written 3 books, 2 Wall Street Journal bestsellers. I sit on city council in my hometown. But what excites me today is I do executive coaching and fractional COO work. So that's where my time is focused these days.
Makes sense. Now, like a lot of things, we go through different things and ventures to, I want to say it's sort of like a journey to figure out who we are, mm-hmm. right? I mean, and everybody goes through it at some point. I mean, like we don't just, you know, wake up, come out of our mothers and decide that we're going to be an astronaut at 25 because we just know. And anyways, it's all about the learning process and the journey and figuring out things like that. Like, what made you interested in this sector versus, like, because like you said, you're into the restaurant business, you're into insurance, you've done a few things. I'm imagining that you probably knew that it wasn't really a passion from the get-go. I mean, sometimes there's excitement about it, but there's a difference between excitement and passion. And usually we know, and often a lot of times, because we have an income that we're satisfied with, or we have a desire that we know we can achieve, we ignore the fact that we're not passionate about it. We just continue on.
Sure. I mean, I've never been passionate about any of the companies that I own. My first was landscaping. I hated it every day for the 10 years I did it. I just was miserable. Fortunately, it's unfortunate and fortunate, right? The business collapsed. I lost everything, had to start all over again with a wife and a 3-year-old. But fortunately, it collapsed and I had to start over with a wife and a 3-year-old and I'm moving into the next phase of my life, which was insurance. Again, not something I'm passionate about, but that allowed me to get into the venture capital world. I did do 2 venture capital deals, move into the private equity world. I did a private equity deal, which ultimately led me to get into consulting and sales management and training, which I really enjoy. But I hadn't been able to do that if I hadn't failed in the landscaping company, moved to a different industry, ended up in a venture capital exit, and then a private equity exit. So it's weird how things connect, right? And then I sold my companies and I bought a restaurant. Not because I'm passionate about owning a restaurant. I just want to eat and drink for free whenever I go in because I think it's cool. But here I am 14 years later. I've had 15 restaurants and I'm ready to get out of that one. So at this point in my life, I'd written a couple of books on business and sales and had done a little bit of consulting work with people. And I just really enjoy working with organizations, sales organizations, operations, and that type of stuff, and helping people accelerate their business, accelerate their sales, make things more efficient. I really, really, really am passionate and enjoy that. So that's how I got into my current field.
Fantastic. Now, you said you wrote 2 books. I mean, I think the latest one is the, the Dropout Multimillionaire.
Nope, that was the book number 2. Book number 3 was called No, and it's the Psychology of Sales and Negotiation.
Interesting. I thought it was the opposite.
And there's another one coming out in April called The Invisible Multimillionaire. It's scaling your business, preparing for an exit, and creating generational wealth.
Wow, that's awesome. What's the passion behind writing the books? I mean, like, why do you do that? Let's be honest. In 2024, people don't become millionaires through writing books.
No, you make no money writing books.
Exactly. But
I wrote my first book. It was actually called I Give the Dumb Kids Hope, which is a little controversial title. And it's talking about me, not anybody else, for anybody who's offended right now. And it started out as a book for my kids and turned into a book about overcoming past life trauma, overcoming failure and continuing on to succeed at whatever it is you want to do. And I finished that one and I thought, well, if they're going to succeed, they really ought to know how to launch and scale a business. So I wrote The Dropout Multimillionaire. And then I got that done and I was like, well, they really need to learn how to sell because that's one of the most important things you can have in any business. So I wrote that book. And then I got a buddy who does mergers and acquisitions, and he's done like $1 billion worth of mergers and acquisitions in the last 5 years. And we got together and I'm like, people really need to know how to sell these companies now that they have them so they can create this generational wealth we keep talking about. So that book's in the works. All those books are tools. They're all tools to help people, to work with people, so they've got somewhat of a guide, but also bring them into the fold so we can show them how to do what we do.
Awesome. That makes sense. Love it. Love it. So now going into this, right? Like, I mean, you're into the, like you coach people, you teach them on sales. Mm-hmm. And sales is usually sort of like one of those industries that you mentioned the word sales and it's like, ooh, cooties. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
In general. But I mean, let's be honest. If you look at the list of careers, the one that's been consistent and the one that's consistently driving results is the sales in a field.
Look, you can make more money and travel the world for free working for organizations as a top salesperson. Organizations compensate you, send you on trips. I mean, there's just a crap load of money to be made in the sales industry. And then if you can convert that into your own business, you can take that even to the next level. So, you know, the world runs on sales. I don't care what your product or service is. Somebody's got to sell it. I don't care how good of an engineer you are. Somebody still has to sell your product. So sales makes the world go round, man.
Absolutely. Now, somebody wanting to work with you, what is the exact process? Like, I mean, I'm sure it's not somebody goes to a website, clicks on a button, all of a sudden they've got a contract with you. I mean, let's be honest, there's always a funnel of how to work with people. So let's get into what that process is.
Yeah, from my perspective, I tend to focus on, we call it two training tracks. The first one is financial and the second one is sales. Both of those training tracks are based on financial analysis. And so if you are going to come to me and say, hey, I want to work with you in my company, whatever it is, and I work for anything from restaurants to technology companies to window and door companies, the very first thing I ask anybody before we get started is I need 24 months worth of P&Ls. Side by side, month over month, completed. I need to see all that. Let me do some analysis. And once I do that, I can come back and tell you without ever stepping foot in your business, without knowing anything about the details, I can tell you what's going right. I can tell you what's going wrong. I can tell you your trend factors. I can look at your core metrics. I can tell you where your business is going to go in the next 12 months if no decisions are changed. And then if you tell me what your goals are, we can reverse engineer them back to today and give you an exact plan for how to get there. Same thing with the sales organization. Show me your sales, your lead flow, your marketing costs, your close ratios, performance by each individual salesperson. We do what we call individual P&Ls. So when we're done with that, I give you a tracking dashboard that will both accelerate your sales and give you ability to identify the good and the bad instantaneously so we can make decisions on what to change. So it's really two intensive tracks all based around data.
Yeah, it makes sense. Absolutely. I mean, do you ever get pushback when you ask for that?
Then I don't work with them.
Interesting. That's.
I can't help you if I don't know what your numbers are. And quite frankly, your business will probably fail if you don't know what your numbers are. You would be surprised, John, how many people don't have those numbers, though. I got a client right now I've been waiting for over a month because he's still waiting for his accountant to get them back to me. And he's already paid me. Like, okay, well, you've paid me. I'm sitting here waiting for you to give me what I need. Until then, we don't need to have a call.
Makes sense. What would you say is your biggest challenge, you know, in the process?
The first biggest challenge is, like I just said, a lot of people don't know what their numbers are and they don't understand the importance of knowing what their numbers are. They don't understand what the core drivers are. So the biggest challenge we have is when we point that out is for someone's ego to get in the way and say, but that's not how I do it. I'm like, well, it doesn't matter how you do it. The data says this. I know you think it's that, but the data says this. Like, I had someone tell me, we don't do a lot of marketing in January and February because it doesn't work as well. We don't get as many leads and we don't sell as much. And I said, really? I analyzed your data over the past 2 years and those are the two best months you've got from a close perspective.
Yeah.
You aren't spending money, but you're closing at a 30% higher close rate. So the data tells me that when you start cranking your dollars up is not the right time. And they were like, well, we've never analyzed that data before. We just assume this is the way it's always been done. Like, well, it's time to change that assumption.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. And again, a lot of times what I found, and this is my personal experience, is that people take general data and think that general data applies to them.
Right.
Right. So, and that's probably how they got that, right? Like, yeah, if you're in retail, your January is going to suck.
Yeah.
Right. Because everyone does the thing in December, but that doesn't mean every business is retail.
Right. I'll give you another funny one. Another company had people that sit on the phone and do calls, sales. And I said, show me your occupancy. And they were like, well, what is that? I said, well, track how many minutes they're actually on the phone doing their job versus not on the phone doing their job, right? Doing something else. And we came out to an occupancy of about 50%. And I said, what that means is your people are only working 4 hours out of an 8 hour day. The other 4 hours, I don't know what they're doing, but they're certainly not working. So the more people you have, the less efficient you are, the less you're getting done, the more money you're paying. You could literally start cutting people out, increasing your occupancy from 50 to 80%, save money as an organization and not lose any productivity. But people don't see that because they don't dig deep enough into the data.
Yeah, that's true, which is, I think, is a little bit of the sign of the times. And what I mean by that is that we had this lockdown, without mentioning what it was, we all know. And at that point in time, this whole concept of working from home became a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Now, what I found in general from observation is that when, you know, we're going into what we call hybrid, you know, methods now, where people are in the office half the time, working at home the other half. Now, what I've observed is that in the office, they're not as efficient. And I don't know if it's just noticeable now or if it was always that way. but it's one of those things that it's almost like a rebellion. Like, you're going to make me come to the office, I'm going to produce half. You know, like, it's
almost detrimental is what it is. It's a problem.
Yeah. So where I'm going with this is, what are your thoughts on this working from home? Do you believe that people can be more, you know, can be productive at home, more productive, or do you really believe that they're doing their laundry and doing the work half the time? I mean, there's different speculation, and I know it doesn't apply to everybody. There's always exceptions, but what do you think the general rule is?
So I always use the 80-20 rule to start with, right? So whatever we say is probably 80% accurate and 20% doesn't apply. That being said, there's no possible way people are as productive working at the house. Just isn't possible. I mean, I have a very good friend who is a stand-up, incredible employee, but we'll go have two-hour lunches, right? You're not having two-hour lunches if you're in the office. But him and I will go have two-hour lunches because, you know, whatever. I'll get back to the house. I'll work later. So I know if good people are doing that, then the people who aren't as conscientious are doing it even worse. So no, I don't believe work from home is the answer.
Yeah. A lot of people think actually that eventually, right now, look, we're going through a change again, like a cycle change with the economy and all that. And I believe as positions are becoming scarce and, you know, changing, and AI is going to take a lot of jobs. They'll create some jobs as well, but that'll become a very talented skill and not just a basic worker. I think as people start noticing their colleagues are disappearing due to layoffs, it's the natural routine. People get worried and either they start looking for a job themselves or they pick up their pants. And and I think at that point in time, a lot of return to work will happen.
I jokingly say, John, that I own a restaurant chain and we try to work at home. We told our customers, just come in, leave the money and go home and make yourself something. Didn't work.
Yeah. Awesome. Now, when you get into, like, when you're out there, you're obviously, how do you target your clients? Like, I mean, because I don't believe everybody can be everything for everyone. And I believe the more niche down and focused people are and more focused the message is, the better, they become. So what is your target niche?
My specific are the two tracks, right? I have two tracks. Number one, historical P&L analysis, applying pattern recognition to identify core metrics to look where your business was and how you got here, then identifying a goal set using reverse engineering to bring it back to where you are. So I can literally, it's called time travel. I can literally tell you based on your history where your business is going to go. And if you're going to change it, then we have to set a new set of targets and reverse engineer to get there. That's a pure operational standpoint, line by line analysis on your P&L. And then the second is your sales organization. So we specifically work on scripting. We work on building individual P&Ls, and we work on lead flow, lead conversion, and profitability. So I'm very specific in the two tracks that I work on. Now, funny enough, when I get into an organization, we end up getting much deeper. Like I just literally had an in-person session that left 30 minutes ago that's been here for a day and a half, and we were much, much deeper than those two tracks. But that's the two tracks that I focus on initially.
Yeah, no. What I meant is like, how do you target industry? How do you target companies, right? Like, because I'm sure it's not that you just turn on your phone and the phone rings. You had to build up a brand and
it's all from social media. It's from these podcasts. Somebody will listen to your podcast and they'll say, hey, man, I really need that kind of training. And they'll hit my website and look at the stuff that's on there and send me a message. I've literally done no active marketing. It's literally just been a byproduct of podcasts that I've been on. I do I do probably 100 podcasts a year. And then the social media stuff that I put out, just people listen to it and get attracted.
There we go. Which proves the point that this stuff works.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. I love that. Right. Like it's, I'll be honest, I didn't expect you to say this, but you know, it's what I believe in as well.
I told these folks today, they're like, well, you know, is social media going to work? I'm like, listen, you might have to put out 50 videos, but if it gets one client, that's all you're looking for. Right. So you just keep doing it and somebody's going to see it somewhere. And that person leads to the next and leads to the next. And pretty soon it rolls.
Absolutely. It's about providing value. And if you're providing the right value and not a smoke show, it'll get attention.
Yeah. Yep. 100%.
I also believe that, look, let's be honest, we're entrepreneurs. And as an entrepreneurial journey, we're always, you know, checking things out, analyzing, trying to decide, are we on the right path? Do we need the curve? Do we need to change? Should we, you know, pour more gasoline on what we're doing because it's doing so well? But there's always that element of fear, which is why most people choose to become the employee over the employer.
Sure.
Because it's always that fear, right? I always believe every business that you're building, you don't know if it's going to succeed at the beginning. I mean, you have your hunch because you wouldn't start it if you thought it was going to fail.
Right.
But you would try and you have a hunch. But there's a certain point, what I call that aha moment, where you realize, okay, maybe I might have to do some curbing, but I'm in the right spot.
Right.
What was that aha moment for you? And I know many businesses have many of them.
You know, it was the same one for me as I find for a lot of entrepreneurs. And it's one of the things I talk about a lot and work with. It's that fear that you're speaking of that keeps entrepreneurs from making the correct decisions from a delegation standpoint that hinders their ability to grow and scale their company. And by that, I mean this. Too many entrepreneurs get started and because they're afraid of, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Should I spend the money? I don't want to hire somebody because I'm afraid they won't justify their cost. I'm afraid even if I have employees to turn over critical tasks because I can naturally do them better and faster, so I might as well do them. And I'm afraid if I let somebody else do it, they won't do it as good. I'm afraid I might lose a customer. I'm afraid that, and it's that fear that keeps people from saying, okay, I really need to scale this company. So if I'm going to do that, I can't be doing the dishes. I can't be washing the floors. I can't be cleaning up after everybody. I can't be cleaning out the I can't do those things. I can't do the administrative tasks. I can't do the sales and marketing. I can't do the it's that fear that somebody else won't do it as well as you that keeps you from scaling. And what I tell people all the time is you need to offset that fear with this concept. You will never hire anybody as an entrepreneur that is as good as you, because if you do, then they would be an entrepreneur and they're going to go off and do their own thing. So if you can find people that are 80% as good as you, you've got a home run. You might have to backfill that other 20% with a part of another person. But if I have 10 people 80% as good as me, I've got 800% of my own personal capabilities. So don't let that fear keep you from being able to properly scale your business and grow it to where you want it to go.
Yeah, I agree with you. I also think there's always some exceptions. Like prime example, we were talking before we started recording. We were talking about how I tried to be the jack of all trades when it comes to my podcast and record my own shows and stuff. And reality is that, I mean, even though I have technical skills, I mean, I plug in everything, so I must have some skills to be able to know how to do this. But I'm not really an expert on this. And I have a tendency that I'm either too bright, too dark, you know, things cut out, whatever, like just the sound is not loud enough, too quiet, whatever. Where I'm going with this, though, is that, as I said, and I decided I sold off all my equipment other than the one I use for my you know, like at home. And I got a crew to do it. Why? Because maybe I'm not, like, my crew won't be as passionate about my show as I am, but their technical skills are going to be right on the ball.
Yep.
And if I'm focusing on the technical part, I'm not focusing on the guest.
Right.
Right. So by doing that, they're actually doing something better than I can do, not passionately, but technically. And on top of that, alleviates all that stress from me. So it allows me to be more productive elsewhere.
100%. Yep. You're exactly right.
So awesome. 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 So now, how long have you been doing the coaching business?
So I did on and off kind of ad hoc coaching for the past 20 years, quite frankly. I've got, you know, half a dozen people who will tell you that I'm their mentor, so to speak. I got serious about it 1 year ago. I had no social media following. I had no Instagram account, no TikTok account. I had 99 followers on Facebook and probably that many on LinkedIn. Nothing. So really jumped into this with the goal of building a base and creating a brand and whatnot. We went through two brand iterations over the first 6 months because I couldn't figure out what I was trying to accomplish. I joined five different masterminds. I dropped $100,000 in coaching fees before I finally started to focus in and hone on what exactly my message was, what exactly I'm trying to do. And we figured it out really about 3 or 4 months ago. And since then, it's just been a whirlwind. Picked up like 75,000 followers on social media. I've been on Fox News, Fox Business, the Glenn Beck Show, the Daily Mail, the New York Times. I mean, it's when you finally figure it out, it starts to roll. And then clients just, again, like I said before, they start seeing you everywhere and they start calling. So it's been an interesting fun ride over the last year.
Well, definitely. Again, it goes back to what I always say. It's about the journey. If you're not enjoying the journey,
yeah,
then there's no point in doing it, because at the end of the day, everyone wants the end result because they think that's what's important. But there's many, many people that get to the end result and they're not fulfilled.
Right.
Right. So, and the other thing, let's look at the ultimate end is we're dead.
Yep.
Right. So why in the world would we want the end result? I think, you know, go enjoy the journey. Have fun.
Yeah. My friend, I have a friend out in Park City. His name's Paul Pilser. Super great guy. Been a mentor of mine for 20 years. When I sold the last two companies, I was having lunch with him and he said, Brian, what are you going to do now? And I said, I don't know, Paul. He goes, I said, maybe I'll start another business. And he said, why are you going to do that? I said, I don't know. That's all I know how to do. I've never done anything else. I was just head down, dark to dark for 20 years. He said, well, what are you passionate about? I said, passion? I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what passion is. I'm just a business guy. That's what I do. That's all I know how to do. It's all I've ever done. I don't know what passion is. And he said, Brian, let me tell you something. He's a wildly successful guy. He said, let me tell you something. You need to find something you're passionate about, whether it's business or not. And you need to find a way to give back to the world some of what the world gave you. Because if you don't, you will spend the rest of your life chasing money and you'll never create true happiness. It was like one of those mic drop moments. And I was like, and it literally took me another 5 years before I started to figure out what my passion was and how I was going to be able to give back. But I've never forgot that one statement he said at lunch, you know, things that stick with you forever. And it was in my mind rolling around for the next several years until I started to figure out what I wanted to do.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, you're right. It is a mic drop moment. And obviously, let's be honest, it takes more than just passion and it takes more than just motivation. I mean, a favorite quote from somebody that I followed for years and still listen to his work is that motivation alone is not enough, because if you take motivation, motivation alone is not enough, because if you take an idiot and you motivate him, all you get is a motivated idiot. So that came from Jim Rohn. Where I'm going with that is that, you know, I mean, passion is important. Passion will keep you on the grind when things are hard. That's the main thing. But action is just as important.
Right. Agreed. Yep.
Awesome. Now, for an inspired entrepreneur or somebody who's looking to get into their own business, maybe they're an employee, maybe they're just graduating, maybe they're going through school but have ideas, who knows? Like, they just want to do something and they just know the path they're on is not what they want to do.
Right.
What would your advice be?
So I tell people this all the time, and this applies to somebody like you're talking about, who's brand new, thinking of starting a business, to somebody who has a business that may not be going the way they want it to go, to somebody who has a business that may not be growing or scaling as fast. Here's the deal. If you've never done it successfully, you don't know what you're doing and you don't know how to do it. And so there are two options for you. You can either do it like I did, which is the hard way, which took 20 years before I figured out how to be successful in business. And that's grinding and losing money and or you can find a good coach or a mentor and bring them in. Somebody who's 20 steps ahead of you, who's already done it, who can say, hey, John, man, don't do that. Do this. Hey, John, I've already tried that. It's not going to work. Hey, John, if you'll do this, this, and this, that will accelerate your growth, your revenue, your profits. It'll accelerate everything you're trying to do if you just do what I'm telling you to do. Find a good coach or a mentor and then listen to them, and your success will accelerate exponentially.
Which brings up the point, right? Because you've had a lot of mentors. You talk about mentors a lot, and clearly that could be very important. But let's be honest, there's a lot of gurus out there, especially now that the internet is around. And there's a lot of gurus that like to talk but never deliver or have never delivered themselves. Look, I'm not, without mentioning companies, I mean, I'm in the real estate business. There's a real estate company that came out that offered a way for people to bring people on into the company, and they get paid for just bringing them on. Then they tried to play coach. You know what I mean? Like, but most of these people in the beginning, at least, now it's different, but in the beginning, these people who left really stopped selling real estate and started getting money from basically referral fees. And what I mean by referral, you bring them on to the company, and they come every time they order, they work, you get a percentage.
Yep.
Right. So it's like, okay, well, you didn't make money by selling real estate. Now you want to coach these people on how to sell real estate.
Yeah.
right? Like it's mind-boggling.
I know you're talking about. I know you're talking about.
So the question is really, how do you figure out who the real mentors are and who these social gurus are?
I say you have to vet the person you're going to allow to put information in your brain very, very hard. What have they done? What have they succeeded at? Have they done what you want to do? And it doesn't mean I want to build a landscaping company. Have they built a landscaping company? It means I want to build a landscaping company. Have they built a business successfully that can show you how to do what they've already done? People can't teach you what they've already done. I'm sorry. People can't teach you what they haven't done. They have to have done it. So find somebody who has been there, done that successfully. I know one of those people you're talking about right here in my hometown, and I know her for a fact. Every single business she's been in has failed, and yet she's a master coach, which just kills me. If anybody tells me they're a certified master coach, I immediately dismiss it. Sorry. So yes, vet them hard. Make sure they are who they are, have done what they say they can have done, and can actually help you and aren't just, talking about it.
I've also discovered that many people who have had true success have also had many failures.
100%.
Now, if someone tells you that they're successful 100% of the time.
Yeah, probably not.
Either they're not really that guru we're talking about, or they're lying and don't want you to know what it is.
Yeah, you're 100% right.
So, I've had, my first success was in the marketing print business. But my first round, I did high six figures, almost seven figures. Then I ended up being bankrupt.
Yep.
The second round, I figured out what I did wrong the first round.
Yeah.
And I dropped my ego and learned humility.
Yep.
And that grew to eight figures and I sold that business.
Yeah.
So then I had another one that I thought was wonderful. And a lot of people go, I'm going to make six figures. Ooh, 150K a year sounds great. But really, that's a job, not a business.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So then I had a third one that that did very well. Now, I stopped that one when my parents got sick because I had to, I ended up staying home with them. So I just closed it down because mm-hmm. didn't know how long I was going to be out, which turns out was the right move because I was out for 5 years. So I would have taken a 5-year loss to hold on to it. And then the market changed anyway. So now right. When I closed it, I did not know it was the right move. I just didn't know what to do and I had to make a decision.
Right.
But the point is, it took, and again, it's not this Instagram thing. You do something 90 days away, you're the most successful person on the planet. Before that business turned into something real, something that I can actually talk about and not just pretend, it was about 3 years.
Yep.
So, it's consistent work over and over and over with consistent progress and growth with the ability to, adjust as you need.
In my case, I am a 20-year overnight success.
Yes. And that's exactly where I was leading to in the long way.
Yes. 20-year overnight success.
Absolutely. So, and there you go, right? Absolutely love it. Now, another unique question, or at least I think is unique, is that there's many people that get into businesses, some for the right reason, some for the wrong reason. Sometimes their temperament changes and they find out some people are very successful, financially,
mm-hmm.
but something, and an emotion we both shared is they may be, cash is pouring in, but they're miserable as hell.
Mm-hmm.
What would your advice be to that person?
Cash is pouring in, but they're miserable.
Yes.
I would sell the company and do something different. I don't want to spend the rest of my life being miserable every day.
Love that. Love that.
There's a lot of ways to make money. Being miserable is not a good one, not a good way to do it.
Right. And contrary now, if you have someone who's constantly losing money, they're not, they're not completely passionate about it, but they don't hate the business,
mm-hmm.
but they feel that's all they know.
Right.
What would you say to that person?
Look, I was in the landscaping industry. I got into that industry because I failed out of high school, graduated finally with a 1.2 GPA, tried to go to college, couldn't hold a job, ended up as a busboy in an Applebee's, married my wife who was a waitress, launched into my first business, landscaping, hated it every single day for 8.5 years. I was miserable. The best thing in the world that ever happened to me was that business collapsed and failed and forced me to go into a different industry. I stayed there because I didn't think I had any skill sets or ability to do anything else. That failure forced me to try something else. And so I started to try to sell insurance and turned out I was top 1% in the country in insurance sales, something I never knew. But learned very quickly that, oh my gosh, I can actually sell. What a crazy concept. And so immediately started my own business. A year and a half later, sold it to a venture capital firm, made my first $1 million. So just because you don't think you can do something doesn't mean you can't do it. And if you're going to be miserable, I would try to figure out how to do something else. That's, I don't know how else to say that.
Love that. The other thing I got to want to mention is, for anybody watching or listening, is that I don't believe people should be avoiding failure instead of looking at it as a learning opportunity. Because reality is that the only way you're going to find success is by trying things. And by trying things, you're risking something failing. There's no shame in failing. It's a shame to not try.
I love what Mark Cuban said. I saw this on some interview he did. And he said, look, take 100 shots. Take 1,000 shots. It only takes one to change your life forever. It doesn't matter what happened to the other 99 out of 100, right? Success is a progression. It's a progression of ideas, executions, learnings, failure, learning, fail. I also hate the phrase, you have to fail to succeed. I hate that phrase because failure doesn't lead to success. Failure leads to failure. Learning from failure leads to success. Too many people, and you know them, John, just like I do, they tend to fail over and over and over. It's because they never learned the lessons they needed to learn. And there are other people who succeed at everything they do. That's because they've learned the lessons and how to be successful. So failure is not a bad thing if you learn from it. It's only bad if you don't learn, right? Sometimes you win, sometimes you learn. So you got to learn.
Awesome. I got like 3 questions before I go into what I call the lightning round.
All right, here we go.
And I'm going to get into a touchy subject about debt.
Okay.
What are your thoughts? Because some people believe, like you have the Dave Ramsey way, where you spend the money you have, even if that means it's a slow growth, slow and steady, and you don't get into debt, you don't borrow money. Other people look at it and say, you don't borrow money for consumer items, like, you know, consumables, like that are a waste of time that have no return on investment. But if you're doing it for an investment, like whether it's in a business or into real estate or whatever, borrow away. And there's different, avenues where people say, hey, you borrow at 4% and you go out and get 8% somehow or something like that. Everyone has a different perspective. What is your perspective on using debt for business?
So mine is a mix, right? I am not in the Dave Ramsey camp of all debt is bad, because that just doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't give you the ability to go out and build businesses if you want to build businesses, right? If you want to build a business and if you want to create something big, the reality is you're going to have to probably borrow some money. So I'm not in the Dave Ramsey camp. I'm also not in the other gurus out there who say, borrow every single dime you can, put yourself so far in the hole that, you know, you're too big for the bank to let you fail, if you know what I'm talking about there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So I'm not in that camp either, because that you can very quickly, if you are not, and I mean an expert at what you're doing, if you're telling that to a layperson or someone who's just getting started, you are taking a very high risk of bankrupting yourself and get yourself in trouble, right? So I believe in calculated risk. I believe in calculated debt, but that calculated debt and calculated risk need to be tempered and overseen, maybe not by you, but somebody else who is much, much better at analyzing that type of stuff, to come in and say, you know, John, I know you're all excited about this project, but I got to be honest with you. I've seen 6 projects like that and 5 of them failed. So maybe that's not the best one. Take your emotions out of this and let's look at this logically. On the other hand, they might come in and go, holy crap, that's a good investment. I would put my money in that. Now, today I'm in a different world, right? In my world today, I have money. And I make money. Those are 2 different things, by the way. We call that rich and wealth.
Yeah, yeah.
I am willing to risk what I make, but not what I have, right? So I don't touch my assets, but I will spend every dime of my income in investing, right? So I have a certain amount of money I know each year that I can dump into investments. That's my way of doing it, because I know I can't be hurt that way. Number one, I've still got my assets. Number two, I'll make more money next year. So depending on where you are in life, depending on where you are in your journey of money and wealth creation, will really determine what your debt exposure risk should look like. Coming out of the gate, people are like, yeah, but so-and-so did it and they made a killing. I'm like, yeah, that's awesome. 10 other so-and-sos did it and lost money. So we might want to analyze this a little tighter, a little differently than just getting all excited about borrowing money and buying stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you on that one. Now, again, at the same time, it also becomes on your own personal temperament. Like, prime example, there's some people that, they can't borrow $10 from somebody for 2 days and they don't go to sleep. If that's the case, you know what? Maybe scaling your business to massive levels isn't for you, if that's what it is. And maybe that slow and steady growth is for you. Do it the Dave Ramsey way, if that works for you, right? I mean, if you can't, if $10 is going to mean you're not sleeping for 2 days, then don't bother.
Yep.
But at the same time, also don't go chasing the shiny object and decide that you need to borrow $100,000 because it looks good.
I'll tell you the problem I got into in my first business before it collapsed is I went from a kid with nothing to building a business and building a business and building a business. But what I also did at the same time is I increased my lifestyle, borrowed more money, bought a Mercedes, got a sports car, got a motorcycle, got a house at the beach. And then I was living on 101% of my income because I'd borrowed all this money, thinking that my business would never have a problem. Let's think back to 2020 when that thing hit. And all of a sudden, my business had a huge problem. My cash flow was cut off and that debt sunk me.
Yeah.
I lost everything because I was too far in debt. And so you got to be very, very careful.
That's going to happen now. There's many, many companies out there that borrowed money when the interest rates were 3%. Mm-hmm. And now all of them are coming due today when interest rates are 7%.
Yep.
And what ends up happening is their cash flows have slowed down and their interest and payments have gone up.
Yep.
There you go. And that's a recipe for disaster.
Yep. 100%. I had a guy ask me the other day, one of the people I work with, he's like, I've managed to save X number of dollars, but I don't spend anything on myself. When do you think I can spend money? I said, do you have more cash than debt? He said, yes. I said, great. You can spend all the cash over the debt. As long as you got that cash available to keep yourself from ever getting hurt, you know, go buy the beach house if you want to. Go buy a Ferrari if you want to. It doesn't matter. You still can't get hurt.
Yeah, I have a philosophy here that I'm going to share, and it's a new philosophy. I didn't always have it. Again, we share the common thing where we learn the hard way. And so this is one of my lessons is that, and it goes to, you're living this way now, is that don't spend your principal assets. Don't spend, what you have. Protect your assets. Protect your fortune. Now, the way I believe, you want a Mercedes? No problem. The when you can buy that Mercedes is when you have enough investments where the passive income, also known as interest, is paying you enough money to be able to afford the Mercedes. When the interest pays the Mercedes, then you can buy the Mercedes. In the meantime, keep driving whatever you're driving.
Agreed. 100%.
Awesome. All right. Second last question is going to be, how do you know you've had a successful day?
I go to bed with a smile on my face.
Great answer.
Pretty simple. And it could be anything from I had a day at the lake to I closed a deal to I helped somebody overcome something or increase their, whatever it is that makes me happy. If I go to bed and I'm smiling, I had a good day.
Awesome. Last but not least is going to be for everybody who's watching this or listening to this and want to know where to find you, where would they go?
BrianWillMedia.com is my website. BrianWillMedia.com. My books, my podcasts, my blogs, newsletters. I have a school community. If you know what school is, everything is on my website.
Beautiful. All right, let's get into the lightning round, which is just a short few questions about you personally. With question number one going to be, what is your favorite food and why?
I like Italian food and I have no idea why. Maybe I love pasta.
Awesome. Pasta is good. Maybe not for my belly, but it's good.
Yeah, exactly. Same here.
Awesome. Favorite travel destination and why?
I literally just got back from St. Bart's Island yesterday. I was there for a week. I love the Caribbean islands. Just can't get enough of that blue water and sunshine. It's awesome.
Yeah, I love it. Wherever it's warm, sunny and warm, that's my recipe. Awesome. Favorite book and or podcast?
Favorite book? Gosh, I've got a bunch of favorite books. I would say my favorite ultimate business book is called The E-Myth Revisited.
I've heard of that.
And then also Malcolm Gladwell. I love his books. So those are probably my favorite business books by far. And what was the other one? Favorite podcast?
Podcast, yeah.
Oh, you mean besides mine and yours? Of course. Mean, we have the best two podcasts out there, right?
Well, of course. That everybody knows.
I love listening to a guy named Dave Meltzer, if you've ever heard of him.
I've heard the name before. I've never heard his podcast. Yeah,
I always tell people, if you remember the Jerry Maguire movie with Tom Cruise, Sports One Marketing Agency was Dave Meltzer's agency. So that movie was based on his agency, which is
probably why I heard the name.
Yeah. And so he was also the head of Samsung, I think, at one point, helped created the first smartphone. He today is a coach to Fortune 50 CEOs, several of them. Just he's he talks a lot about, you know, passion and empathy and growth and person, you know, I love listening to Dave. He's a good guy.
Makes sense. Awesome. 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 All right. The final question is going to be, if you were given unlimited amount of money, but only 48 hours to spend it, what you spend, you get to keep. What you don't spend gets taken away. What would you do?
Oh, I'd buy real estate. because I know real estate ultimately has the income potential. It's got appreciation potential. I can leave it to my children. There's just so many advantages to doing that. I don't need flash anymore. I would buy real estate, let it create it, recreate that residual income that could last for generations for my family, create that generational wealth.
Love it. Love it. Love it. And I have the same thoughts. I'm totally into the real estate investment. Now, a key word is you're buying landlord-friendly places. So anybody yes. watching, you know, make sure you know where you're buying it because it really matters.
Yeah, 100%.
Awesome. Brian, it's been amazing. I want to say thank you so much for being on the show.
John, I appreciate you having me. I had a good time today.
Me as well. Absolute pleasure. If you like what you saw and you want to see some more, subscribe to the link below. Thanks for tuning in to the John Papaloni Show.